And away we go. We're in Daniel chapter 5 tonight. In case you're wondering, I think we're in week 8 or 9 of our study. Yes, that's a good reminder. If you have cell phones or whatever, put it on silent. I don't know how well you can hear me from the further rows. This is about as loud as I'm going to talk. So if you want to move up at any time, I won't think it's rude. If you need to go to the bathroom at any time, I won't think it's rude. Okay? All right, Daniel chapter 5. And I just want to let you know, if you have a bookmark that you can keep in a second place, I want you to put that bookmark at Isaiah chapter 44. Because we're going to be looking also tonight at Isaiah 44 and Isaiah 45 as these things relate to what we're going to be talking about. By the way, just to let you know that there is an archaeological little tidbit that's been in the news this week. Well, I should say it's back in the news. A friend of mine posted it on Facebook, and so now it's making the rounds again. It's actually from July of last year, but we're going to talk about that in the second hour. For those of you who came in just in the last few minutes, we're going to try something. I'm not doing necessarily a full hour tonight, but beginning either next week or the following Wednesday, we're going to start to have two hours. The first hour, our study in Daniel, then a break, and then a second hour where we'll do a variety of things. We'll talk about archaeology, or we might be talking about theology or some social issue from a biblical perspective. It'll be a potpourri in that regard from week to week, what we do. But every week, beginning in either next week or the week after, we're going to have two modules on Wednesday night, 2 hours worth of study. You're not obliged to stay for both of them, just that we're going to make a second hour available for those who just, you know, want more, because some of you travel a long way. So, and I believe in honoring your time. All right, Daniel chapter 5. I guess I should get there myself, huh? I had my bookmark where we're going to be. Okay, in Isaiah. All right, Daniel chapter 5. Belshazzar the king held a great feast for 1,000 of his nobles, and he was drinking wine in the presence of the 1,000. Let's stop there for a minute because we got a whole lot of historical navigation to deal with. Until 1853, there was no mention in any historical writing that we had of anybody named Belshazzar. Now, you have to know that Daniel is a book that's come under a lot of attack over the years. Liberal theologians in the mid to late 1800s and then into the 1900s, liberal theologians were just convinced that Daniel, if such a person ever existed, was made up in the mind of somebody who lived during the Hasmonean dynasty in Israel, the 2nd century BC. They argued for a late dating for Daniel. They didn't believe Daniel was necessarily even a real person. And of course, these same objections have always been lodged by those who just disbelieve in anything supernatural, disbelieve in the idea of predictive prophecy. But one of the things they loved to pick on was Daniel chapter 5 and Belshazzar. No record of him anywhere. And we had X number of documents from the ancient world, but no mention of Belshazzar. You see, they would argue this whole thing's been made up. Well, in 1853, they discovered some cylinders. And and they've named it the Nabonidus cylinders. Now, the way they sometimes wrote in the ancient world was they'd make a clay cylinder and write around the entire circumference of the cylinder, line after line on the cylinder. And then the cylinder could be rolled into clay to make a permanent record. Or they could put some type of ink and roll it that way. But in any case, they used cylinders. Well, they found these cylinders that were written during the reign of Nabonidus. Now, they had records of Nabonidus, so they knew this guy's for real. We know he's for real. And guess what? He mentions Belshazzar. Actually, his name was written. How was it written out? It's like Belshazzar or something like that, but it's Belshazzar. Anyway, so in 1853, they discovered these cylinders, and it authenticated Belshazzar. And it turns out that Belshazzar was Nabonidus's son. And Nabonidus actually ascended the throne. We'll talk about the sequence of things in a minute. Through assassination. He and a group of cronies assassinated the king at the time and took over. Actually, the king at the time was a very young child. And they took over. And Nabonidus apparently was not a very good king, which shouldn't surprise us. But this is written at a time when Nabonidus was probably already captured by Darius. Had already been captured by Darius. And so you have Belshazzar, who is his co-regent. It's actually his son. Nabonidus's son was Belshazzar. Nabonidus has been captured. Belshazzar now is acting as his co-regent. Because he's not dead, but he's not there. And the idea of co-regency was very common in the ancient world. We have, for example, Uzziah, King Uzziah in Judah. Remember, he was struck with leprosy when he presumed to go into the holy place? He was struck with leprosy, and he had to live in isolation to the day of his death. He's still reckoned as king, but now his son Jotham had to act as co-regent. So some of their dates overlap each other, Jotham and Uzziah, because of that. And so co-regents were not unheard of at all. It was fairly common. So anyway, just a little bit about that. One of the old arguments, 100 years ago, 150 years ago, no such person as Belshazzar, it's all legendary, blah, blah, blah. Well, now we know that Belshazzar really existed, and he was Nabonidus' son. Okay, a lot to say just about that one verse. But let's look at what's going on. Belshazzar the king held a great feast for 1,000 of his nobles, and he was drinking wine in the presence of the 1,000. What's he doing drinking wine and having a big party when at that very time the city of Babylon was surrounded by Darius's armies? Sorry? Yeah, they didn't go golfing. Yeah. Touche. No. But the walls around the city of Babylon were unbelievably strong and fortified. They had moats. I mean, the wall was something like 19 feet thick. They had moats, the iron bars. They had guard towers. The wall went up. How high did those walls go? I mean, those walls were... Yeah, the walls were 22 feet thick and 90 feet high, and the outer walls also had guard towers another 100 feet higher. I mean, the city was considered impenetrable. The city gates were made of bronze. They had these outer walls, they had moats. I mean, the city was very secure. We're going to look in Isaiah about the boasting of it. So Nabonidus is probably at this very moment as we read this captured by Darius, and we have the historical record that he was captured by Darius, which is why we're reading about Belshazzar. And he's having a party, and they're drinking wine, because he is so sure that nobody can possibly get to them. Nobody can possibly get to them. They're so boastful about their wonderful city of Babylon and its impenetrable walls. Verse 2, when Belshazzar tasted the wine, he gave orders to bring the gold and silver vessels which Nebuchadnezzar, his father, and actually that word father there, in historical context, you can read as ancestor, but not even, he actually wasn't a blood relative of Nebuchadnezzar. He's called his father in the sense that Nebuchadnezzar occupied the throne, and then whoever occupies the throne after him is his son. Okay, that's very common ancient Near Eastern reference to talk about the succeeding kings as the son of Nebuchadnezzar, or, and then looking back, your father. So there's no actual blood relationship between Belshazzar and Nebuchadnezzar, at least not that we know of. All right. He gave orders to bring the gold and the silver vessels which Nebuchadnezzar, his father or predecessor, had taken out of the temple which was in Jerusalem, so that the king and his nobles, his wives and his concubines might drink from them. Do you remember what happened to the Philistines when they captured the Ark of the Covenant and took it away from the tabernacle of Israel? It did not go well. Well, in this case, Nebuchadnezzar, God gave Judah into Nebuchadnezzar's hands. So God wasn't punishing Babylon for taking the people captive or for capturing all the gold and the silver vessels. By the way, you'll be hard-pressed to find anything in the Torah that specifically where God is saying, I want you to make a whole bunch of gold and silver drinking cups. That was in part Hezekiah's kind of boast. Anyway, verse 3, they're drinking now from the cups, the gold vessels that had been taken out of the temple. Verse 4, they drank the wine, and here's where it gets really bad. They drank the wine and praised the gods of gold and silver, of bronze, iron, wood, and stone. That's a really bad idea. Really bad idea. You're drinking the consecrated cups from the temple in Jerusalem, the temple belonging to the one true God, and you're going to just have a drunken party and start, hey, let's hear it for the God of wood. Yeah. Let's hear it for the God of bronze. Yeah. Turn to Isaiah 44 for just a minute. Beginning at verse 9. Those who fashion a graven image are all of them futile, and their precious things are of no profit. Even their own witnesses fail to see or know, so that they will be put to shame. Who has fashioned a god or cast an idol to no profit? Behold, all his companions will be put to shame, for the craftsmen themselves are mere men. Let all of them assemble themselves. Let them stand up, let them tremble, let them together be put to shame. The man shapes iron into a cutting tool and does his work over the coals, fashioning it with hammers and working it with his strong arm. He also gets hungry and his strength fails, so he drinks no water and becomes weary. Another shapes wood. He extends a measuring line. He outlines it with red chalk. He works it with planes and outlines it with a compass and makes it like the form of a man, like the beauty of man, so that it may sit in a house. Surely he cuts cedars for himself and takes a cypress or an oak and raises it for himself among the trees of the forest. He plants a fir and the rain makes it grow. Then it becomes something for a man to burn. So he takes one of them and warms himself. He also makes a fire to bake bread. He also makes a god and worships it. He makes it a graven image and falls down before it. Half of it he burns in the fire. Over this half he eats meat as he roasts a roast and is satisfied. He also warms himself and says, ah, I am warm. I've seen the fire. But the rest of it he makes into a god, his graven image. He falls down before it and worships. He also prays to it and says, deliver me, for you are my God. They do not know, nor do they understand, for he is smeared over their eyes so that they cannot see, and their hearts so that they cannot comprehend. No one recalls, nor is there knowledge, nor understanding. In other words, it doesn't dawn on them to say, I've burned half of it in the fire, and have baked bread over its coals. I roast meat and eat it. Then I make the rest of it into an abomination. I fall down before a block of wood. He feeds on ashes. A deceived heart has turned him aside, and he cannot deliver himself nor say, is there not a lie in my right hand? God will give people over to their wickedness and foolishness if they insist on it. He will give them over to that. And so what we have here in Daniel chapter 5 is the king of Babylon, at this time, co-regent named Belshazzar. His city is surrounded, as we read this, by the armies of Darius the Mede. And he's having a party. And they're getting drunk. And he calls for the vessels from the temple in Jerusalem, which his predecessor Nebuchadnezzar had destroyed. And they start drinking out of the consecrated cups and praising the false gods of wood, stone, bronze, etc. Verse 5. Suddenly, the fingers of a man's hand emerged and began writing opposite the lampstand on the plaster of the wall of the king's palace. And the king saw the back or the palm of the hand that did the writing. Remember Paul Simon's song, Kodachrome? He talked about, my lack of education hasn't hurt me none. I can see the writing on the wall. That whole expression we have. I can read the writing on the wall. It's a way of saying, I wasn't born yesterday. I know what's going on here. You're not fooling me. That's what we mean by it. But that expression, I can read the writing on the wall, this is where it comes from. So they're in the midst of this drunken party. All of a sudden, a hand shows up. Now, the plaster on the wall of the king's palace was not wet. It's not like, oh, I'm in the middle of, you know, I'm putting the addition on my house and No. But the hand wrote into that wall as though it were wet and wrote a message. A hand. I don't know how big the hand was. Maybe it was just a regular sized hand, but it's just a hand. How do you think you would react? I used to tell a scary joke. I don't know if I should tell this joke. It was such a silly joke. Okay, I'll tell the joke real. I'll do the short version. Guy goes to the doctor's office. He's sitting there. The doctor comes in. They talk. They consult for a few minutes. Doctor says, I have to go out for about 5 minutes. Please just wait here. By the way, please don't open what's in that box. Don't open that box over there. It's very sensitive. All right, well, the doctor's gone 5 minutes and he hasn't come back. Guy's just really getting curious. What's in that box? 10 minutes, the doctor's still not back. Now the guy's a little put out, like, I've been waiting. And the doctor says, 15 minutes. He says, forget him. I'm going to look what's in the box. He opens the box and some smoke comes out and forms a hand. And it turns toward him and starts coming at him. He's backing up, but the hand is coming towards him. He opens the door and runs out of the office in his robe. And the hand is chasing him through the office, down the hallway. Finally, he's at an elevator and he's waiting and that elevator isn't coming. The hand comes up to him. And he's like, oh, and the hand goes, you're it. Okay, that's my joke. All right, anyway. Aren't you glad you came to the Shema Bible study tonight? So Belshazzar and company, it says 1,000 of his nobles. By the way, they excavated not long ago in Babylon a room in the palace that was enormous, just enormous. So it was not at all difficult to conceive of the idea that he had a party for 1,000 people. And they're drinking and they're praising the false gods of all these elements and just giddily doing that and disrespecting the Lord God of Israel. And all of a sudden, this man, a hand shows up, writes in the wall, many, many, or mina, mina, tekel, uparsin. We'll get to that later. So the hand writes on the wall. The king sees the hand, and look at verse 6. Then the king's face grew pale, and his thoughts alarmed him, and his hip joints went slack, and his knees began knocking together. Daniel, can I remind you that we're still in the Aramaic section of Daniel? This isn't just writing to his fellow Hebrews and going, you know. No, this is in Aramaic. Everybody's going to be able to read this. Remember what we talked about last week? God has purposes for men and women of every nation, tribe, people, and language. He wanted everybody to know through his servant Daniel that you don't mock God. All right. So anyway, in verse 6, we have his knees are knocking, he's collapsing, he's growing pale. Verse 7, the king called aloud to bring in the conjurers, the Chaldeans, and the diviners. Does that sound familiar? It's like every time there's a problem, they call all the wrong people and they ignore the one guy that they should have called to begin with. So he calls the conjurers, the Chaldeans, and the diviners. The king spoke and said to the wise men of Babylon, any man who can read this inscription and explain its interpretation to me shall be clothed with purple and have a necklace of gold around his neck and have authority as third ruler in the kingdom. Why third? Remember what Nebuchadnezzar had done? Can make somebody second in the kingdom. How come Belshazzar says, whoever can read this and tell me what it means will be made third? Because he himself is the second. Remember, he's a co-regent. Nabonidus, his father, is still alive and technically king. He's co-regent, so he's second. He only has the authority to make whoever can do this the third. All right? Verse 8. Then all the king's wise men came in, but they could not read the inscription or make known its interpretation to the king. Then King Belshazzar was greatly alarmed. His face grew even paler, and his nobles were perplexed. The queen entered the banquet hall because of the words of the king and his nobles. Now, this is almost certainly not his wife. Okay, this is probably not Belshazzar's wife. He's king, she's queen. This is probably his mother. It might even be his grandmother. Okay? The queen entered the banquet hall because of the words of the king and his nobles. The queen spoke and said, O king, live forever. Do not let your thoughts alarm you or your face be pale. There is a man in your kingdom in whom is a spirit of the holy gods. Again, we've seen that expression repeatedly. That's how the Babylonians thought about things. In whom is a spirit of the holy gods, and in the days of your father or predecessor, illumination, insight, and wisdom like the wisdom of the gods were found in him. And King Nebuchadnezzar, your father, or as we have talked about this, your predecessor, your father the king, appointed him chief of the magicians, conjurers, Chaldeans, and diviners. This was because an extraordinary spirit, knowledge, and insight, interpretation of dreams, explanation of enigmas, and solving of difficult problems were found in this Daniel, whom the king named Belshazzar. Let Daniel now be summoned, and he will declare the interpretation. verse 13. Then Daniel was brought in before the king. The king spoke and said to Daniel, "Are you that Daniel who is one of the exiles from Judah, whom my father the king brought from Judah? Now I have heard about you." He's acting like, "Yeah, I know about you. Yeah, he just found out." Either that or he was just reminded of something he ought to have known full well. "I have heard about you," verse 14, "that a spirit of the gods is in you, and that illumination, insight, and extraordinary wisdom have been found in you. Just now the wise men and the conjurers were brought in before me, that they might read this inscription and make its interpretation known to me, but they could not declare the interpretation of the message. But I personally have heard about you, that you are able to give interpretations and solve difficult problems. Now, if you are able to read the inscription and make its interpretation known to me, you will be clothed with purple and wear a necklace of gold around your neck, and you will have authority as the third ruler in the kingdom." Now, we have the benefit of hindsight. That kingdom ended that night. You could be king for 5 more minutes. You know? Third in the kingdom for 5 minutes. Now, I'm looking at this as we read through it, and Daniel is described in very glowing terms, albeit inaccurate in the sense of spirit of the holy gods. So, in a Babylonian sense, this is the highest praise that could be given to a person. And this is in Aramaic, the language of the people there, so everybody's going to be able to read this. It's for public consumption. This is not in Hebrew. And it's describing Daniel in such glorious terms. If we didn't know better, we'd say, "Boy, Daniel, you're laying it on kind of thick about yourself here." But he's just recording what happened. Simply recording what happened. And Belshazzar, though he was not a good king, nevertheless was royalty, and it is common in royal spheres in the ancient world to elaborate and be somewhat verbose. It's just the style of things. We saw a little of that in Nebuchadnezzar. Belshazzar seems to be a very showy person. "I have heard about you that this and this, and I have personally heard about you that this and this and this." I think that's really just a little more Belshazzar style. Daniel is not patting himself on the back here. He's just recording what happened. Yeah, Belshazzar is drunk. And people do tend to go on, don't they? I have no excuse. I don't drink, but I have no excuse. All right. Verse 17. "Then Daniel answered and said before the king, 'Keep your gifts for yourself, or give your rewards to someone else. However, I will read the inscription to the king and make the interpretation known to him.'" By the way, that took some courage. Keep your gifts for yourself, or give them to somebody else. I don't want it. Daniel's not intimidated by Belshazzar. I get the sense that he didn't think very highly of Belshazzar. With Nebuchadnezzar, it was, "Oh, my lord, the king, if only this terrible interpretation applied to your enemies." To Belshazzar, it's keep your gifts. But I'll tell you what it means. Daniel's a man with a real history, and he's not afraid. He's, by the way, he's probably in his 60s at this point, possibly his 70s. Nebuchadnezzar reigned for 43 years, and after him, Evil-Merodach ruled for 2 years. He was assassinated by his brother-in-law, Nergal-Sarnessar, who ruled for 4 years. Then Nergal-Sarnessar died a natural death. His son, and I'm not even sure I'm pronouncing this, Laborosorakhod, who was only a child, ruled for only 9 months. He was beaten to death by a gang of conspirators, and the conspirators were the ones who appointed Nabonidus, who was one of them. So we're talking about 43, 47, almost 50 years. And even though Daniel was a na'ar, a youth, when he came to Babylon, he's probably in his 60s at this point. And he may very well have been retired, as it were. All right, in any case, let's come back to our text. Daniel says, keep your gifts, but I'll tell you what it means. Verse 18. O king, the Most High God granted sovereignty, grandeur, glory, and majesty to Nebuchadnezzar, your father. And again, by that he means your predecessor, not necessarily literally your father. Because of the grandeur which he bestowed on him, all the peoples, nations, and men of every language feared and trembled before him. Whomever he wished, he killed, and whomever he wished, he spared alive, and whomever he wished, he elevated, and whomever he wished, he humbled. But when his heart was lifted up and his spirit became so proud that he behaved arrogantly, he was deposed from his royal throne, and his glory was taken away from him. He was also driven away from mankind, and his heart was made like that of a beast, like that of beasts, and his dwelling place was with the wild donkeys. He was given grass to eat like cattle, and his body was drenched with the dew of heaven, until he recognized that the Most High God is ruler over the realm of mankind, and that he sets over it whomever he wishes. That whole phrase sounds familiar, right? That whole phrase was repeated several times in chapter 4. And it's been many years. And Nebuchadnezzar had published that. Remember we talked about how Nebuchadnezzar... Have a seat, Helen. Nebuchadnezzar had published this for everyone to see. He was very transparent about it. I was arrogant. The God of heaven humbled me, and here's how it happened. Right? And he said, and this has been around for years. It's not like this was some little hidden thing that he didn't want anybody to know about. He wanted other people to learn the lesson he had to learn the hard way. Nebuchadnezzar was a changed man. Belshazzar knew full well all about this. So Daniel's not telling him something he didn't know or that wasn't readily available. Verse 22. Yet you, his son, or his successor, Belshazzar, have not humbled your heart, even though you knew all this. But you have exalted yourself against the Lord of heaven, and they have brought the vessels of his house before you. And you and your nobles, your wives, and your concubines have been drinking wine from them. And you have praised the gods of silver and gold, of bronze, iron, wood, and stone, which do not see, hear, or understand. Stop. Daniel wasn't at that party. How does he know what they've been doing? I expect that Daniel was already dressed and ready to go when the people came to summon him. Yeah, I know what this is about. Let's go. I think God revealed to him exactly what was going on in that party. Daniel comes. The king tells him what's going on. Daniel already knows. He wasn't there when they were praising the gods. They're just there. And they're all like, right? Because they're frightened. But he's a prophet. He knows. And you have praised the gods of silver and gold, of bronze, iron, wood, and stone, which do not see, hear, or understand. But the God in whose hand are your life breath and all your ways, you have not glorified. Then the hand was sent from him, and this inscription was written out. Now this is the inscription that was written out, Mina, Tekel Upharsin. This is the interpretation of the message, Mina. God has numbered your kingdom. It's from the word to count. God has numbered your kingdom and put an end to it. Tekel has to do with weights. Probably related to shekel. Tekel, you have been weighed on the scales and found deficient. Peres, or ufarsin, but from the verb peres. Your kingdom has been divided and given over to the Medes and the Persians. We've seen that name Peres before. When Judah had relations with his daughter-in-law, Tamar, gave birth to two sons, Perez and Zerah, twins. Perez means breach, division. So there's common grammar among all the Near Eastern languages. So they were different in some ways, but enough of a common language that we see Perez and we go, oh yeah, Perez, breach or division. Verse 29. Okay, so here's the message. Many. God has numbered your kingdom and put an end to it. Tekel, you've been weighed in the scales and found deficient. Peres, your kingdom has been divided and given over to the Medes and Persians. Then Belshazzar gave orders and they clothed Daniel with purple and put a necklace of gold around his neck and issued a proclamation concerning him that he now had authority as the third ruler in the kingdom. That same night, Belshazzar, the Chaldean king, was slain. So Darius the Mede received the kingdom at about the age of 62. I look at this and I think, Daniel was made third ruler in the kingdom. Belshazzar's killed that night. That makes him number two. Nabonidus is already in Darius's custody. And as we know, because the book of Daniel does go on, Darius didn't kill Daniel. Now what we're going to find out is Daniel had as big an impact on Darius as he had had on Nebuchadnezzar. And he's in his probably in his 60s, maybe even 70s at this point. Reminds me of the proverb that talks about even in their old age they will be green, very green and full of sap. We love the Lord and His Word. We can have meaningful impact in people's lives even at an older age. So we have the fall of Babylon in Daniel chapter 5, and the beginning of the Medes and Persians, the reign of the Medes and Persians. Just to put this in some kind of historical framework for you, Darius is the one who's going to make the decree, right? The Jewish people can go back. Darius's son would be Xerxes, better known as Ahasuerus, the same Ahasuerus that married Hadassah, Esther. So just to give you some sense of where we are historically. And I want to bring this back to God's greater purposes here. Belshazzar, on the one hand, is a blip on the radar, right? God has so many bigger things to accomplish for the people of the world. Belshazzar's small potatoes. Oh, he's the king, but he's small potatoes in God's account. And yet, he had the same opportunity that Nebuchadnezzar had, that Belshazzar's father Nabonidus had, that all of the kings had all along the way who had the record of Nebuchadnezzar's humbling and then coming to his senses and realizing the Most High God, the God of Israel, is the only true God. And they had this knowledge. Why would God even bring this knowledge to Babylon unless he cared about Babylonians and Medeans, Persians, and everyone else. It's just wonderful how God accomplishes so many things with one and the same circumstance. Israel, specifically Judah, needed to be disciplined because of their disloyalty to God. And so their punishment, their discipline was 70 years in Babylon. And it cured us of idolatry. It cured the Jewish people of idolatry. We've got other problems, but after Babylon, we didn't have problems with carving pieces of wood and layering them with gold and bowing down to them. It cured us. But God also cared about the Babylonians and wanted them to have an opportunity to know who he is. And so, in one and the same circumstance, Israel receives the discipline that we needed. Babylon receives the witness that they needed. And individually, Nebuchadnezzar and Darius received the witness that they individually needed. God cares about Israel. God cares about the nations. God cares about individuals. But Belshazzar really blew it. Really blew it. And that was the end of Babylon. That night. So Daniel is left third in charge of the kingdom, and now Belshazzar is dead, and in comes Darius, and Daniel's now number two. And I'm just wondering, I would just love to know how their first introduction went down. Because, I mean, if I'm reading Daniel right, he didn't stay for the party. If I know our friend Daniel here, as soon as they were done with the hoopla, he probably went back to his house and took off all the regalia and went back to his books. They might want to kill you. But boy, would I love to know how that first meeting went down between Darius and Daniel, because it was going to be a very consequential relationship. Let's speculate a little sanctified speculation. Let's assume that Daniel did not stay for that party. That's not his thing. He's done his job. He interpreted. They did all the hoopla. You're now number three. Yeah, whoop-de-doo. Goes back home and takes off all the gold and the purple. Darius kills Belshazzar that night. He says, all right, who's next in line here? Oh, well, that would be Daniel. All right, where's Daniel? He's not here. What do you mean he's not here? Well, he's one of the Judean exiles that Nebuchadnezzar brought, and he's probably back home. And I'm just wondering, if that's how it went down, what Darius is thinking when he finds him at home, probably just sitting there studying the Torah or praying. Okay, this is not the conduct of a typical king, to be just quietly about his business in his own room, reading the scrolls, the prophets, or of Torah. This is a different kind of guy. Well, Darius is now king. So Darius, he's just conquered Babylon, the city that nobody thought anybody could ever conquer. So I'm sure he's like very secure. I'm king. And I just wonder, I really wonder, wouldn't you love to ask God, can we see how it went down that night? And what Darius' first interaction with Daniel looked like. I would love that. All right, back to Isaiah now, chapter 45. Actually, we're going to be looking at a couple of things. Isaiah 40, let's see. I have here 44:28 and following. Let's see if this actually works. Let's begin it actually verse 24, Isaiah 44:24. We've just finished, you know, we had read about the lunacy of idolatry, right? Now in 24, thus says the Lord, your Redeemer, and the one who formed you from the womb. I, the Lord, am the maker of all things, stretching out the heavens by myself and spreading out the earth all alone, causing the omens of boasters to fail, making fools out of diviners. Right? We just saw that again. He called the diviners, the conjurers, the magicians, the Chaldeans, and they couldn't read what was on the wall. Right? God says, causing the omens of boasters to fail, making fools out of diviners, causing wise men to draw back and turning their knowledge into foolishness, confirming the word of his servant and performing the purpose of his messengers. It is I who says of Jerusalem, she shall be inhabited, and of the cities of Judah, they shall be built, and I will raise up her ruins again. It is I who says to the depth of the sea, be dried up, and I will make your rivers dry. It is I who says of Cyrus, he is my shepherd, and he will perform all my desire. And he shall declares of Jerusalem, she will be built, and of the temple, your foundation will be laid. Thus says the Lord to Cyrus his anointed. By the way, there were no chapter divisions when this was first written, or verse divisions. That's why I just went right on. Thus says the Lord to Cyrus his anointed, whom I have taken by the right hand to subdue nations before him, and to loose the loins of kings, to open doors before him so the gates will not be shut. I will go before you and make the rough places smooth. I will shatter the doors of bronze and cut through their iron bars. I will give you the treasures of darkness and hidden wealth of secret places, so that you may know that it is I, the Lord, the God of Israel, who calls you by your name. For the sake of Jacob, my servant, and Israel, my chosen one, I have also called you by your name. I have given you a title of honor, though you have not known me. I am the Lord, and there is no other. Beside me, there is no God. I will gird you, though you have not known me, that men may know from the rising to the setting of the sun across the earth, right? That there is no one besides me. I am the Lord, and there is no other. The one forming light and creating darkness, causing well-being and creating calamity. I am the Lord who does all these. Those words were written about 700 B.C. The events that we read about in Daniel tonight took place, about 150 years later? God names Cyrus over 150 years before the man was even born and says, this one is going to be the one. He'll be named Cyrus, Koresh, who will do something on my behalf for my people Israel. And I'm declaring it now. That from one end of the earth to the other, men may know that I'm the Lord. And we read about that. Isaiah chapter 47. Beginning at verse 6. I was angry with my people. I profaned my heritage. In other words, I humbled them and gave them into your hand. This is talking to Babylon, the king of Babylon. Gave them into your hand. You did not show mercy to them. On the aged, you made your yoke very heavy. Yet you said, I will be a queen forever. These things you did not consider, nor remember the outcome of them. Now then, hear this, you sensual one who dwells securely. Who says in your heart, I am, and there is no one besides me. I will not sit as a widow, nor know loss of children. But these two things will come on you suddenly in one day, loss of children and widowhood. They will come on you in full measure, in spite of your many sorceries, in spite of the great power of your spells. You felt secure in your wickedness and said, no one sees me. Your wisdom and your knowledge, they have deluded you, for you have said in your heart, I am, and there is no one besides me. But evil will come on you, which you will not know how to charm away, and disaster will fall on you, for which you cannot atone, and destruction about which you do not know, which will come on you suddenly. This is a prophecy of the fall of Babylon. And it happened in a night. And Belshazzar and his friends were just so sure that nobody could touch Babylon, that they're in a drunken state and the city was taken. Apparently, according to the historical annals of this, let me find this. In October 539 BC, Cyrus advanced into Lower Mesopotamia and, leaving Babylon till last, conquered and occupied the surrounding territory. Here it is. Okay. The ancient Greek historian Herodotus relates that the Persian king Cyrus conquered Babylon by diverting the flow of the Euphrates into a nearby swamp. This lowered the level of the river. Remember, they had moats. So that his troops marched through the water and under the river gates. They still would not have been able to enter had not the bronze gates of the inner walls been left inexplicably unlocked. Exactly what God predicted in Isaiah 44 and 45 and Jeremiah 51. God opened the gates of the city of Babylon for Cyrus and put it in writing 200 years before it happened. It's a sign of the decadence of Babylon, their pride in themselves and in their city, that their watchmen weren't doing their job, the gates were unlocked, the leaders were in a drunken stupor. Yeah. And David Guzik in his notes points out the fall of Mystery Babylon will be very similar. These ebbs and flows of history, things repeat themselves. People become proud and boastful and suppose that God doesn't see, and nobody will ever conquer us. We will always be secure. Sorry, doesn't go down that way. Like the Titanic. Yeah, like the Titanic. The boast was this ship cannot be possibly be sunk. Piece of ice did it. So there's really a tremendous lesson. And Daniel chapter 5, in a lot of ways, sort of like the focus of the showing God's power, but also the folly of godlessness and how it all comes down, just tumbling down in a day. So there really is a lesson that we need to learn of humility. Nebuchadnezzar learned that lesson. His successors apparently did not learn the lesson of humility. All right, questions? Chris? Chris is saying that he's heard a teaching somewhere that Daniel took that gold chain, saved it, melted it, did something with it as a gift for Messiah. That maybe it was one of those wise men that brought gold to Yeshua when he was a child, that was the gold from Daniel's chain. That's interesting. No way on earth to prove that. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, ultimately, it's all his anyway. Think about it. When Satan said, took him up on that high mountain and showed him all the kingdoms of the world and said, I'll give you all these if you'll fall down and worship me. It was all going to be his anyway. But Satan was trying to tempt him to receive those kingdoms without having to go by way of the cross. To do it without the suffering. And Yeshua rebuked him. But all the kingdoms of the earth and all the gold and everything else, it's all his. It's all his. Susan?
Is it possible that the wise men had some understanding of what was going on with Jesus because of Daniel's presence?
Very good question, and you're right. Let me just repeat it for the sake of the recording. Susan said that, is it possible that the wise men of whom we read in the Gospels had knowledge as a direct result of Daniel's presence in Babylon? Absolutely. It was Judah going captive into Babylon by which Babylon was given the knowledge of the Holy One of Israel and the words of the prophets. Remember, too, that Daniel read the prophet Jeremiah while in Babylon. And remember, Jeremiah didn't live that long before. So it's not as though these scrolls were unavailable. So yes, absolutely. The wise men knew of, just as Daniel and his friends were required to learn the language and the literature of the Chaldeans, the wise men of Babylon and later Media and Persia, I mean, their whole livelihood was learning. And so they would have been familiar with some of these Jewish prophecies. And they were aware that there was supposed to be born one who was going to rule over Israel. They probably knew about the prophecy from Numbers chapter 24, a star shall arise from Jacob, a scepter in Israel. And they knew that there were going to be heavenly signs attending the birth of that great king. They saw a unique sign. It was in the direction of Judea, and these wise men put two and two together and took the journey. Good question. Any other questions? Okay. What I'm going to do is we'll go ahead and I'll pray and then we'll be dismissed if you want to leave. If you'd like to stay, I'm going to have another like 20 minutes or so. One of the things I want to do is tell you about this archaeological discovery and what the ramifications are. And then we can also just have some time for questions and answers. So let me pray. If you need to leave, please don't feel bad. If you're able to stay, that's great. And we'll have like about a 5-minute break and then we'll come back, okay? Lord, thank you for our time together this evening. Thank you for your word. Oh, Lord God, help us to learn the lesson the easy way by reading of the faithfulness of Daniel and the folly of Belshazzar, that we might not be arrogant, that we might not be proud in our hearts or think that we have done anything, or that we might not ignore you and look at everything around us and praise the stuff and fail to recognize that everything is from your hand. You raise up kings and you bring them down. You raise up nations and bring them down. But Lord God, we thank you that you are also the God who sees even in the deep places of our hearts and knows our pain and our worries and our hopes. And you care about us as individuals. Thank you. Such knowledge is too wonderful for us. We cannot attain to it, and yet we just rejoice that you care about us and that you've written our names, those of us who have trusted in Yeshua, in your book of life. Thank you for our time together this evening. Please go with everyone and give them safe travels in Yeshua's name. Amen. So 5 minutes and we'll come back in.